Hello, welcome to the China Journal of Democracy podcast. I'm your host, Weifeng Zhong. As many of our listeners know, the mission of this journal is to spread democratic ideas to the Chinese-speaking world. It's a Chinese publication. And that obviously includes a lot of people in China who have access to the content published by our journal. It's my great honor to welcome the guest to the podcast, Professor Duran Acemoglu at the MIT. Who's also the 2024 winner of the Economics Nobel Prize. And today is a very special day because as we record this podcast on June 4th, it's the 37th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And obviously a lot has changed and a lot to talk about. So welcome to the show, Duran.
Thank you, Weifeng. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you. How are you?
Excellent.
Let me start with sort of a stage setting question. It's been 37 years, as I mentioned, the massacre on Tiananmen Square, and many people still have the strong passion, myself included, to see China at some point become democracy, if that ever happens. But obviously, this past 17 years, China has gone through a lot of changes. What's your view on China and how has it evolved over these past few decades?
Well, look, I mean, I think there is a huge area in academia of Chinese scholarship, and it's a very complex topic. But obviously, China has, in some sense, charted a unique course of authoritarian growth that is still highly innovative, but the system has many contradictions within it, which make it, first of all, not a good model for other countries, but also, secondly, questions the durability of the current structure. What's very remarkable about China is that it has achieved, as everybody knows, very rapid economic growth. But different stages of that growth are rather different, and perhaps we shouldn't bundle all of them into a single Chinese growth experience since the collapse of Gang of Four and the opening of the system. The first phase was very much driven by agriculture, and it was not necessarily under the control of the central party. So it had many of the elements of a bottom-up process. But the second phase, especially after Tiananmen Square, is much more controlled, more industrial, but also more authoritarian in terms of both the political system, but what it also in terms of what that imposes on the economy. And then we now have the third phase that is much more technological, especially focused on AI, but is trying to replicate the second phase because that is viewed as most desirable from the viewpoint of the Chinese leadership and for the durability of the Chinese Communist Party and its elites. It has been remarkably successful in some sense. China is competing with the United States, and in some areas of AI, it has a leadership. But it does not resolve the underlying problems. There is significant demand in China from the middle class for various types of freedoms that's suppressed. And that is intersecting with the economy, as you can see from the fact that there isn't enough internal demand in China, despite rising incomes of the middle class. And the manufacturing surplus in China almost entirely goes into exports. This system itself wasn't stable before Xi Jinping. Some people interpret Xi Jinping's rule as a break with what came before. In my assessment, it's not. It's more of a continuation of the Chinese Communist Party's rule, but the rule was already getting harder because with a rising middle class, there is going to be a need to either make concessions to the middle class, which the Communist Party doesn't want, or tighten the grips in the form of more surveillance, more ideological emphasis on nationalism and other things to divert the middle class. And I think Xi Jinping is the next stage of that. Ultimately, there is nothing that says in human history that you cannot have an authoritarian regime survive for hundreds of years. But you cannot easily have an authoritarian regime coexist with a strong and flourishing middle class. And I think that's where the fundamental dilemma in the Chinese model lies. The engineering talent in China is substantial. The manufacturing base has become very large and very versatile. So all of these things can economically sustain Chinese economic growth for a while longer. But this conflict between what the middle class will ultimately demand or be satisfied with, both in terms of voice, in terms of better quality of services, in terms of environmental demands, in terms of their notions of fairness and good governance, and what is virtuous, what is acceptable, legitimate rule, and what the Chinese Communist Party is willing to tolerate, I think that conflict is going to shape the future of Chinese institutions.
I actually remember quite clearly, even though I was very young in at Tiananmen Square, I was six, but later on I learned that in the earlier in the 80s, this what you described around was precisely the trend that was happening in China with people demanding more freedom. But obviously then we have the massacre. A lot of people also consider that as sort of like a social contract between the regime and the people, right? So
There's a social contract element, and I am open to that. The interpretation that I want to push against is also one that's quite popular, that somehow Chinese culture or Chinese heritage doesn't demand democracy, accepts authoritarian rule, or is even happier or more synergistic with authoritarian rule. It is true that China, especially since the Qin Dynasty, has had a more than 2,000-year period of largely authoritarian top-down rule. But even despite that, ideas of democracy, ideas of freedom are everywhere in China, and they're not erased in Chinese culture. You can see that from the fact that Taiwan is more Confucian than China. In surveys, people report more Confucian values in Taiwan than China. And Taiwan has been able to build a vibrant democracy and sort of reinterprets Confucian values in line with democratic principles. Hong Kong was going in that direction until a very strong crackdown took place from the mainland. But also you see the same things in the 1980s among Chinese university students, the kind of the demands, the aspirations, how rapidly they wanted to go to greater freedoms, greater media openness, greater government accountability was really remarkable. So those ideas aren't dead. They're suppressed. They're less powerful, but they can never be erased. And I think that is also a threat to the social contract. Indeed, there is a social contract. The social contract is exactly what the Chinese Communist Party wants it to be and interprets it as, which is that we rule and we provide stability and prosperity. But at the end of the day, I don't think stability and prosperity are going to be enough for a rising middle class. And stability and prosperity themselves are not guaranteed under an authoritarian system. What we have seen in country after country under authoritarian regimes is that the regime over time becomes less and less capable of having any accountability or any transparency, and corruption and mismanagement sets in. China typically has tried to avoid that since Deng Xiaoping's era by a combination of circulation of elites. Different factions of the Communist Party rose and fell, and a meritocratic recruitment into the higher echelons of the Communist Party. Now, the circulation of elites has largely dissipated in China, which again, I see it as a consequence of the tightening that was necessary given the logic of the system. The meritocratic promotion is still there, but I don't think by itself is going to be able to ensure that the good policymaking always applies. But even more importantly, I think innovation fundamentally requires freedom. We're not seeing that tension in China too much yet because China has been catching up and has really leveraged its very large and very skilled engineering workforce in order to solve problem after problem in manufacturing, in designing consumer products, and in AI. But ultimately, I think that tension is going to show up as well and will become another roadblock on the path to innovativeness in China.
So the technological innovations you mentioned, it's also very interesting in the sense that as you described, China has gone through a lot of catch-up phase, right? But my impression of the Chinese innovation was actually somewhat differently. It was that they try to steal their way up to get close to the frontier. They do reverse engineer. A lot of the Chinese innovation we have seen, you can always trace some Western origin of that. Yeah, China has search engine called Baidu, and it was obviously from Google, and there are countless other examples. So it seems like the uniqueness in the Chinese success was they were able to do copycat up to a certain point, and then somehow just turn on some genuine innovative engine.
100%.
And that made marginal progress on that.
100%. And the copycat aspect was very strong early on. But in AI, for example, while China is still behind in certain areas, it's most importantly in large language models, and there the copycat is still applying, for example, DeepSeek's success was really remarkable, but a lot of it was based on distilling existing models. But in robotics and the integration of AI into the production process, as well as integration of AI into consumer products, I think China is truly innovative. And this is, again, leveraging both its very large markets, internal market, but which is itself not as large as it should be, given that the middle class isn't spending as much as it should, but also its very, very strong engineering base. And you can see that also in DeepSeek as well. DeepSeek's quote-unquote innovations were all engineering fixes that relied on ideas that were already in the machine learning literature, some of them already incorporated into existing models, some of them not quite like mixture of expert models. And DeepSeek really blended them quite successfully. That kind of recipe you see in other things as well. BYD is ahead in robotics than US companies, but it's not because it has invented a new kind of robot. It has really perfected the engineering of integrating robots into the production process.
Right. So in this context, the Chinese system, is it fair to say that the Chinese system is more sustainable because copycat strategy is more sustainable than like really trying to innovate every time?
Because I think the copycat strategy cannot be applied once you are very close to the frontier where China is. So China needs to become genuinely innovative. And there we're going to see more roadblocks. One place you're going to see this is in Chinese academia. China should have a much better academic dynamism, given how much innovation there is in the private sector right now, how big the country is and how much resources it has. But it doesn't. And part of the reason it doesn't is because academic flourishing requires academic freedom. I have some research with David Yang and Jia Zhu, which shows that Chinese academia is very much driven by career concerns, where people are afraid of the power of academic bosses or party bosses in academia, and they divert their research energy accordingly. That kind of environment is a recipe for academia to run out of steam when it comes to innovativeness.
This is, I think, in some sense, maybe bad news for Chinese innovation, but our readers might find it is good news for the, at some point, with the hope that China might become a free society because the pressure on the regime might be heavier.
I don't think it's reasonable to expect China to become a free society anytime soon. I think
what are the paths you could see?
Yes, I think we have to sort of bank on paths that involve the middle class and students making greater demands in terms of access to information, having reliable media sources, and having more voice, first in local government, but also then in national government. That's not going to be without any pushback, but that's going to be the question. Is depending on the nature of the demands and the nature of the regime, the pushback hopefully will not be violent crackdown, and that would open the way. So brother, the fragility of any path to democracy is that once there is a violent crackdown, I think it becomes very difficult to go back to a democratic path. Because a violent crackdown doesn't just suppress the current democracy movement. It also changes the character of that, and it makes it, the democracy movement or whatever opposition movement itself anti-democratic. And we have seen that exactly that dynamic in the Arab Spring, for example. There was a lot of decentralized bottom-up demand for freedom in the Middle East. But it all came tumbling down once repression started, because either it became radicalized, which itself is inimical to further democratic institutions building or broad coalitions, or the regimes got strong enough to withstand the pressure. So I think that is the key in China is to avoid another Tiananmen Square.
And to cultivate a stronger and stronger civil society.
Exactly.
As much as people can. So we also talked about AI. I want to pivot us to talk more about AI more generally. I remember reading your paper, The Simple Macroeconomics of AI. You provided an estimate that the impact of AI over a 10-year window on the total factor productivity, TFP, would be about 0.66%. Sound a little small to me.
It was a little small because the advances have been faster than I had anticipated. But I still would say you'll be disappointed if you expect a doubling of GDP in the next 5 to 20 years. So, I mean, five to 10 years, sorry. It's very difficult to integrate any new technology into organizations, and that's going to be doubly true for AI. And while the advances in foundation models are very rapid and inspiring, building applications on the basis of that is not always easy, and we haven't seen many of them. Now, again, the agentic phase might change that, and there is a question of how the leadership in the agentic phase is going to shape up between China and the U.S. and other countries. But what we are seeing right now is that existing models, however capable they are, they have not really penetrated the production process all that much.
But in the agentic system, though, do you see a huge shock to the way people will work in the future? If we imagine that in the past, a very capable worker in the software world will be a coder, like who codes like a monkey, with all due respect. But now it's like you can use natural language to talk to the AI. The AI could make all the software you want. As an employee, all of a sudden they become a manager or a communicator.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be many aspects of work that are going to change. And therein lies both hope and despair. I think if we want to create more technologies that are going to contribute to shared prosperity everywhere, which is actually, by the way, is completely necessary for democracy in the West. Liberal democracy in the West is in crisis because shared prosperity is in crisis. Then we need those agentic tools to work with the workers, what I call pro-worker AI. And if your agenda is one of automation, you can do that with agentic tools or you can do it with non-agentic tools. Both of them are hard. That's true. I think with agentic tools, there will be new possibilities. But it's not a done deal. What I say is, you know, if you want AI to deeply penetrate the economy, say, for example, change the entire way in which customer service is done, reducing the number of customer service agents by 80-90%, which would be a huge number of workers losing their jobs, then you need much simpler and much more usable and reliable tools based on AI for customer service. So you need something like the Microsoft Office of AI, and that we don't have yet.
But in terms of upward mobility, what should those people who are or who will be replaced by AI, what should they do? Like learn AI or do something else?
Well, I mean, you know, learn AI, of course. I think we all have to understand AI, both in terms of how to exist with AI and also how to work with AI in a way that's productive for us, ethical for us, conducive to career advancement. But no, I mean, look, customer service representatives in this country aren't highly paid managers. If they lose their jobs to AI, they're going to be forced to take lower paid jobs. That's the experience we've had with previous waves of automation. You know, there it's a silver lining that none of this is going to happen at one fell swoop. So there is some time to adjust. Some of the adjustment will take on the worker side. Workers will get retraining. Some of the students are going to recognize the changing demand and will make investments accordingly. Some of the adjustments on the government side, we need oversight over how AI is going. Then hopefully some of the adjustment will be on the technology side. The design of technologies needs to change if we really want them to be more pro-worker. By the way, there, I think China is doing a little better than the US, we have to admit. And the reason why China is doing a little better is because rather than just bank on large language models, China is trying to incorporate AI and robotics into the production process in a piecemeal fashion, which is very engineering intensive, but it increases productivity and it doesn't fully eliminate workers, although it does create some displacement. And China has an imperative to reduce costs because it relies so much on exports, but it has an even bigger imperative, which is to deal with the coming demographic shift, which is the biggest demographic shift that the world, any country has ever experienced. South Korea went through something similar, except that South Korea is much, much smaller than China.
I can attest to that in the sense that I was born in the first year, the one-child policy was implemented in China. and at least where I lived in China. So now it's people my age, they have a married couple will have four elderly to take care of, and maybe, exactly. maybe one child.
And then there's going to be a labor scarcity. The problem is, of course, AI and robotics are a partial solution to that, but you don't want to eliminate jobs with them. You want to make some of the tasks automated while also use the same technologies for making the remaining scarce workers more productive, more marginally productive, meaning they contribute more to the production process.
So complements rather than substitutes.
Complements rather than substitutes, exactly.
So what about the education system? Now, I know you teach at university, but if we think about it more broadly, like from elementary school all the way to, you know, doctoral programs, how should the education system adapt to the fast, you know, fast changing pace of AI?
Well, I mean, I think we need to rethink education completely. But the most important thing is that right now we are not rethinking it, but that doesn't mean that education is not being transformed by AI. It is. Every student is now using ChatGPT or DeepSeek or whatever it is. And there is a recent study that uses a large-scale data from China, which shows the results have been disastrous, that students who use AI learn much less. Their general knowledge goes down by a significant amount. Their exam performance in standardized exams goes down significantly. But there are many possibilities, and it actually mirrors what I've just said in the production process. If we use AI in a pro-teacher way, we can approach personalized education in a cost-effective manner. But instead, what we're doing is we're sort of getting ChatGPT to replace teachers and to replace student effort, which both of those are recipes for disaster.
How would you change students' mindset? Like now they think of homework as a hurdle, right?
So they that's the main thing, because if we had planned this and if we had a roadmap, we could have designed technologies differently so that students were induced to use AI in the correct way. And the evidence also suggests that if students use AI correctly, for example, they work on the homework, they work on the material by themselves first, they learn much more. But the genie is out of the bottle. So you now have hundreds of millions of students. They all have access to zero cost or cheap cost ChatGPT or other models. So you cannot prevent them. So you need to change norms. So students need to understand that they are hurting themselves. But that's very difficult because you're dealing with 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds. That's why their brains are not fully developed.
That's a huge challenge for many people, for the people who are in the system as students, and obviously for people like you who are in the system as teachers.
Yes.
I know we are coming up to time now, but let me thank you before we end, Professor Ajimolu, for joining
thank
us
you.
In the podcast.
Thank you. For readers who are... My pleasure.
Thank you. For listeners who are interested in Doron's work, they can obviously find you by Googling or go on your MIT website. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too. Bye.